Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. I'm Rachel Isaacs, a student from Manalapan, New Jersey, and the engineer for this program. We look forward to learning some Torah with you today. Thank you for tuning in. Today we are joined by Rabbi Meir Schweiger, a faculty member and the Mashgiach Ruchani at Pardes. He will be teaching us about Parshat Bo. A few quick announcements, and then we'll hand it over to Rabbi Schweiger. Do you have a vision for the Jewish future? Have you considered a career in Jewish education? The Pardes Educators Program includes 2 years of subsidized study and living in Jerusalem, leading to an MA degree in Jewish education. Graduates teach Judaic studies in day schools in North America. For more information, see the Pardes website at www.pardes.org.il. Your participation and feedback is vital for the success of the podcast series. Please send us comments on the episode, where you live, and how you heard about us. Send your email to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thank you. That's it, and now Rabbi Schweiger.
Thank you, Rachel. This week, Parshat Bo is the parsha which speaks of the Exodus. What I'd like to do is focus on chapter 12, which are all the preparations that the Jews have to make in anticipation of the Exodus. I very often like to refer to this chapter as experiencing freedom in the midst of slavery, so that the Jews are not freed when they leave, but in fact, the Jews have already been freed before they go. Or, to phrase it another way, chapter 12 is where the Jews have to now become partners with God in the act of redemption. In the plagues, God is the one who is smiting the Egyptians. God is the one who is doing everything, and in fact, we spoke about the four languages of redemption last week. This time, the Jews have to be able to take their destiny into their own hands. Rashi, in his opening comments on the Chumash, says that the Torah should have begun with chapter 12 of Exodus, because chapter 12 lists the first commandments that were given to the Jewish people. And if the essence of the book of the Torah is the commandments, then we should really begin with chapter 12. In his commentary, Rashi goes on to explain why, in fact, the Torah begins with the story of creation. But I would like to now look at what is so significant about this chapter and how this chapter is absolutely critical in beginning to form a Jewish people, a free people. God begins by saying to Moses and Aaron, chapter 12, sentence 2, HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim, Rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. This month is to you the first of months. It is the first to you of the months of the year. The very first commandment which is given to the Jewish people is the creation of a calendar. A calendar which is going to create what we could call Jewish time. Many years ago, I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik that time consciousness is perhaps the most fundamental thing that separates a slave from a free person. A slave has no awareness of time because the time is not his. In fact, one could say that a slave has no appreciation of time. What difference does it make if I accomplish something in 10 minutes versus 20 minutes, when in that extra 10 minutes, whatever I'll be doing will not be for me, but for someone else. And therefore, there's the tendency for someone who's a slave to not rush to get something done unless they're pushed to do so. Because why bother? In the end, okay, I'll just have something else which is loaded on my back. Another quality of a slave is the sense of the routineness of time. Every day is the same. There's no sense of change. There's no sense of something to look forward to. There's the feeling of somehow being in this rut, this endless rut. Someone who's free is someone who knows how to value their time. For them, every moment is absolutely critical. One could say every moment is an eternity. In fact, there's an expression which we sometimes say, which we're not aware of, which is, I have 10 minutes to kill. I could be waiting for a bus. I could be online at an office, at a government office. And I am anxiously awaiting the bus to come or to be able to have my appointment actualized. And then I say to myself, well, what am I going to do until that happens? And there's this feeling sometimes that I just want the time to go away. And yet, that's a slave mentality. Because those 10 minutes could be an eternity. You could open up a book. You could do something. And who knows what could be accomplished in those moments. So that someone who's free knows how to value each moment and how each moment, as I said, can be an eternity. The word in our parsha, which is used for a month, is the word chodesh. It's very striking because earlier in Shemot, in the book of Exodus, in chapter 2, we're told how Moses' mother hid him for 3 months. But over there, the expression is Shlosha Yirachim. Yirachim, which is related to the word Yareach, which means moons. And in fact, the Jewish calendar, which is fundamentally based on the moon, should be referred to in terms of Yirachim. Yet, in our parsha, and subsequently throughout the Chumash, we speak about a month not as a yerach, but as a chodesh. Chodesh is related to the word chadash. And it's based on the idea of the lunar cycle, where the moon waxes and wanes, and yet nevertheless renews itself. And in fact, the rabbis on the verse which says, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, derive another mitzvah, which is the sanctification of the new moon. God showed Moses the new moon and said, when you see the moon this way, sanctify it, declare it. Which means that our valuing of time is rooted in an idea of chadash, of the renewal of time. This is very important in terms of a free mentality. The idea that every moment is new, is fresh. The idea that I don't just, what was yesterday is going to be today. The sense of time which is dynamic. That is what our view of time should be. For the Jewish people, This creates a tremendous sense of optimism. It's true. We were slaves. We've been slaves for an extremely long period of time. Yet at any moment, that could radically change. And there's always a sense of hope. That's connected with the idea of Chodesh. But I mentioned a moment ago that the Jewish calendar is not based on the fact that every month, when the new moon appears automatically, it is the first of the month. But there is a concept of what's called Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctifying the new month. According to the rabbinic understanding, the way the calendar is determined is that you have two witnesses who cite the new moon, who come to the court in Jerusalem, declare that they have seen the new moon, and on the basis of their testimony, the court declares this is the first of the month. And in fact, in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, the rabbis say that if, for whatever reason, the court declares the new moon on the wrong day, that declaration is still valid. As we know, the lunar month, the lunar cycle, is a 29 and a half day cycle. And as a result, there are some months which are 29 days, some months which are 30 days. In theory, every 30th day could be the new moon. But sometimes the rabbis might declare the 31st day as the new moon. And their declaration is valid. From this we see that the Jewish calendar is not something which is objectively determined by the reality, but is actually determined by human declaration. It's not enough that it happened. We have to acknowledge it. We have to declare it. And even the expression sanctifying the new moon reflects the idea of sacred time, the realization that we declare this as being a holy day. And one could even argue it's not only the holidays, the holy days, which are sanctified, but in this act of sanctifying the holy days, we also declare every moment as being holy. And it's only a question of acknowledging the gradations of holiness and of acknowledging the different spaces of time, of activity. This time awareness is something which is a central theme throughout this chapter. And I'll cite two examples. The Jewish people are told to take the Pesach offering on the 10th of the month. But on the 10th of the month, they're not supposed to do anything with it. They're supposed to hold on to it until the 14th day, and it's only on the 14th day that they slaughter it and eventually eat it at the Seder, which will happen the night of the 15th. On the one hand, the Jews are told, mark that 10th day. Make sure that you get ready for the big event. And yet on the other hand, it seems that even though they take that lamb and have been diligent in getting the process going, they have to somehow wait till the 14th and perhaps allow the significance of what this event means to sink in. So that there's this very interesting tension of, on the one hand, being quick, being energetic, not being lazy, and yet on the other hand, not being impulsive, but being able to wait for the right moment to be able to do what you need to do. In the same light, the Jews are told when they're eating the Pesach sacrifices, they're told that in sentence 11, Make sure that your loins are girded, your shoes are on your feet, your staff is in your hand. Eat it quickly. Once again, this sense, you should be ready, be dressed, do it quickly. And the sense is because at any moment you could be leaving. And in fact, Pharaoh calls out to the Jews in the middle of the night and says to them, leave now. But the Jews don't leave in the middle of the night. In sentence 22, God says explicitly, but you will not go out of your household until the morning. On the one hand, the Jews have to be ready for the Exodus, be all dressed, be psychologically prepared. But when they leave is not when Pharaoh tells them to do, but when they're ready to leave, when God tells them to. Had the Jewish people left in the middle of the night, it would have been chaotic. It would have been like slaves who are grabbing an opportunity to just run away. God wanted the Jewish people to leave in the middle of the day, to leave as a dignified people, in full view of the Egyptians, as a proud people, not running away, but leaving on their time, at their pace. So that it's very interesting how this time consciousness forces us to have to balance contradictory elements. On the one hand, to be diligent, and on the other hand, to be methodical. Not to be too laid back, and at the same time, not to be impulsive. There's another element which comes up in our parsha. The Jews are told to do a number of things which were only relevant in Egypt. One that I mentioned a moment ago was the idea of taking the lamb on the 10th. A second element was that when the Jews slaughtered the animal, they were supposed to take the blood and put it on the doorposts. And therefore, what we see is that there are certain elements which make the Jews very much conscious of their unique situation. And I'll come to this in a few moments when I discuss the Passover sacrifice. But in the same section, the Jews are all of a sudden told about matzah. And not only about matzah, but about an obligation of eating matzah for 7 days, of not eating chametz during that period of time. And in the context of talking about eating matzah, God says, you shall celebrate this holiday as an everlasting holiday. This is in sentence 14. And this is repeated again in sentence 17, which is another dialectic of time. The idea being that on the one hand, I have to be very conscious of the moment, and I have to be very conscious of the ramifications of what I'm doing at this moment. But on the other hand, there's also the idea of seeing how what I'm doing has ramifications for the future, perhaps forever. If we were to step back a moment, it's a little bit mind-boggling for God to be telling the Jews about things which they should be observing in the future. When they will come into the land. And not only then, but for all generations. For a people that right now are enslaved. We would imagine that the thing which is uppermost in their mind is what's going to happen now? What's going to happen tomorrow at the most? But they can't possibly think that far ahead. But once again, this is the quality of a free person. of someone who not only thinks about the moment, but is able to see the long-term ramifications for all generations. I mentioned a moment ago that I'd like to spend a few moments speaking about the Paschal Lamb, the Korban Pesach. When one reads chapter 12 and looks at the first Seder that the Jewish people made, the focus of that Seder is the Korban Pesach. It's very interesting that the matzah is simply ancillary. It's kind of ironic because for us nowadays, there is no temple, there is no Korban Pesach. For us, the matzah is the highlight of the Seder. Why is the Korban Pesach so central in that first Seder? Perhaps to understand this, we have to understand the reality that was in Egypt. It's very interesting that in the fourth plague, when the Arov, and this is a question of whether it's the mixed multitude or the gnats, are brought on Pharaoh, Pharaoh begins negotiating with Moshe. This is in chapter 8. And at one point, Pharaoh says to Moshe, "Why do you need to go and sacrifice outside the land?" That was the request. Give us 3 days to go sacrifice to our God in the desert. Pharaoh says to Moshe in chapter 8, sentence 21, "Go sacrifice to your God in the land." And Moshe's response to Pharaoh is that, in sentence 25, that's an impossibility. In sentence 22, that's an impossibility. How could we sacrifice the abomination of Egypt? At least according to one interpretation, Moses is saying to Pharaoh, "You hold the lamb sacred." In Egypt, lambs were worshipped. They were not slaughtered. If we now go ahead and slaughter your lamb in your eyes, that's an abomination. How could we possibly do that? And Moshe ends sentence 22 by saying, "And will the Egyptians not stone us if we were to do such a thing?" And it's ironic that in the end, that's exactly what happens. The Jews end up sacrificing the lamb in Egypt, the Korban Pesach. When God commands the Jews to do that, this is a test of the Jewish people, a test of their identity. Are the Jews able to break with Egyptian culture, with Egyptian values, and enter into a relationship with God? You have an interesting rabbinic comment in chapter 12. There's a verse which Moshe says to the elders, sentence 21, "Mishchu ukechu lachem tzon," pull and take to you sheep to your families. And the rabbinic comment says, "Mishchu yidechem me'avodah zara," pull your hands from idolatry, "ukechu tzon shel mitzvah," and take the sheep of the mitzvah. This rabbinic comment says it all. The Jews are being asked to now stand up and identify. Are you able to now take that lamb, pull it, bring it into service of God? Or are you going to be like the Egyptians, worshiping that lamb? So for the Jews, sacrificing this lamb is a statement which says, "I have no part in Egyptian culture, in Egyptian society. My relationship is with God." But it goes beyond that. It's also putting their lives on the line. As Moses said, if the Egyptians witness the Jews doing this, they're not going to just sit back and smile. For them, this is an abomination. There's the very real threat that the Egyptians will kill the Jews. Are the Jews now prepared to do this act, which potentially is life-threatening? So this is very much a test of their faith, a test of their devotion to God. When the Jews are told to put the blood on the doorposts, the verse is very interesting. In chapter 12, sentence 13, it says, "Vahaya hadam lachem laot," and this blood will be to you a sign, "al habatim asher atem shama," in the houses where you are, "v'ra'iti et adam," and I will see the blood, "ufasachti alechem," and I will skip over you, and I will not allow the plague of the firstborn, to strike you down. What's interesting is that the verse should have said, and this blood will be a sign to me, to God, and when I see the blood, I will pass over. But it says it's a sign to you. And Rashi even quotes one rabbinic comment which says that in fact the blood was put on the doorposts inside the house. When the Jews see the blood, for the Jews, that's a statement to them of who they are. That's a statement of what they're committed to. By doing this act, they have now broken with Egypt. They have now begun to enter into a relationship with God. They have made a statement which is, not only do we have a relationship, but we're prepared to put our lives on the line. And when the Jews are prepared to run that risk, God is prepared to skip over their house and to save them. So that in this act of sacrificing the lamb, the Jews have redeemed themselves. The lamb is instead of the Jews. They have liberated themselves from Egyptian society and now have become their own people. It's very interesting that the sacrifice of the lamb, the putting of the blood on the doorposts, is something which is done per household. And from this we can see how traditionally, historically, the Seder has always been a family event. And I would like to end with this point. Jewish peoplehood is very much rooted in the Jewish family. It is not only a question of each individual's relationship with God, but each individual who is part of a family unit, and where each family is able to say to itself, and to the Egyptians, and to God, we are the people of God. That family unit is at the core of who we are as a people. And this is what has been the hallmark of the Jews for generations. The reason that I emphasize this is because in a world where there has been a breakdown of the family unit, and where sometimes this has occurred under the guise of liberation and modernity, perhaps there's something very profound about this ancient tradition, this ancient anchor of the family unit, which is devoted to God and which perpetuates itself from generation to generation. At this moment in time, the Jewish people rose to the occasion. It says in the verses that whatever Moses commanded the Jews, they executed to the fullest. When the Jewish people are able to rise to the occasion, to have a sense of who they are, to be able to do acts, which sometimes can be even risky, but are acts of principle, this is what brings about the redemption. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Please tell your friends about this podcast series, and please let us know your thoughts and comments. Send us email via podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks to Dr. David Bernstein, who is the executive producer of the Pardes from Jerusalem podcast series. Shalom and goodbye from Jerusalem.